The Tom Woods Show, episode 1100.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Men, get yourselves an excellent shave at an outstanding price with Harry's and get your $13 trial set for free. Just cover shipping. Check it out at harrys.com/woods. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Peter Schiff is with us today. Of course, you know Peter is CEO of Euro-Pacific Capital. He is known for, of course, calling the 2008 financial crisis really to a T. He was talking about the financial sector. He was talking about the housing sector at a time when nobody wanted to hear what he had to say. He's the author of numerous books and, in particular, Crash Proof, How to Profit from the Coming Economic Collapse. He later had Crash Proof 2.0, How to Profit from the Economic Collapse. He's written other books, including How an Economy Grows and Why it Crashes, which even younger people can read. But he's produces a lot of content, very, very valuable and important. Before we get to Peter, one quick thing, just a reminder. This coming Tuesday, depending on when you're listening to this, it'll be this coming Tuesday, February 27th, 2018, I'm going to be speaking at the University of California at Santa Barbara on the crimes of communism. So that's going to be at 8:15 p.m. at The Hub. All right, so there's that. Secondly, at the end of my conversation with Peter, I'm going to play you something that I think is going to warm your heart. It's a great memory from the old Ron Paul for President days, and I dug it out. I think you're really going to like it. I used to fill in as a guest host on the Peter Schiff Show. Peter still has his podcast, and we'll also make sure and mention that as well. Peter, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks for welcoming me back.
All right, I got, as usual, a bunch of pretty good questions here, and you know, some of them are going to be the sorts of things you get asked all the time, but when you have an occupation like yours, people want to know the same darn things. You know, what's happening? What should I do? But let me ask you something that maybe you haven't been asked in a while. Somebody wants to know, what is it that you were doing in your 20s and 30s that contributed to making you as successful as you are now?
Probably nothing.
Really?
Certainly in my 30s, but in my 20s, I was wasting my time in college. Although I did take a couple of years off between my sophomore and junior year. So I guess that was productive because I did work selling precious metals for a company in Minneapolis. So I guess I learned a little bit about how to sell on the phone. So that probably helped me. Although I had done some of that. I had some sales jobs in high school, summer jobs and things like that after school. But, you know, and then, of course, I started my business in my 30s. So there, I mean, I guess that was real. I really started, you know, building up. I started my broker dealer. I really, you know, I mean, I was a broker a little bit in my 20s. So I guess I got some experience in my 20s, too. I had a small little commodity IB that I partnered up with some people. But I mean, I guess I mainly just kind of learned things on my own because I just was doing things and eventually building up my businesses. But I don't know. I mean, I learned a lot of economics just on my own, reading, you know, stuff, talking to my dad, you know, when I was a kid, and you know, he pointed me in the right direction, and we had a lot of discussions, and so that's, you know, where I learned to think straight with respect to economics and understanding government and the proper role of government and, you know, the destructive nature of government and appreciating our founding fathers and, you know, and what they attempted to do. And what they succeeded in doing for a long time with respect to the United States.
Now that you are however many years old, looking back on it, what would you do differently, knowing, you know, now what the best use of your time would have been as a young man?
Oh, there's a lot of things I would have done differently with the full benefit of hindsight. I mean, but the thing is, you don't know. I mean, there are things that I did that I wish I didn't do, and there are things that I wish I had done that I didn't do. But I mean, I don't know how I could go back and second guess, you know, the decisions I made in real time.
But what about something like college? I mean, that does give you a signaling to the outside world that you've got training. So maybe you still want to do that.
No, I mean, look, I didn't get any benefit. I could have done my job that I got straight out of college. I could have got that job and skipped college. In fact, you know, people used to make fun of me when I had my first job. They used to call me college boy, because no one else had a college degree. You know? So it's like they made fun of it. But yeah, I mean, there were jobs that required a college degree. I just didn't get any of those jobs. Now, I don't know why. I interviewed for them. I interviewed right out of Berkeley for certain jobs. but I never actually landed one of them. So I ended up taking a job, a commission sales job that, you know, didn't require college at all. And then everything I did after that, I mean, college was never a part of it. I mean, it was never an issue. So did I enjoy my college experience? Yeah, I mean, I had some fun. So, you know, would I have been better off skipping it? I mean, it wasn't very expensive. That was the thing. I went to Berkeley. It cost me next to nothing. So I didn't have to borrow any money, and it didn't cost my parents much money for my room and board. So it wasn't a big cost. But, you know, if we had to invest hundreds of thousands of dollars in really what was a worthless degree, you know, I mean, it would be, you know, maybe be different. Now you can think, well, could I have spent my time better? Could I have used those 4 years more productively? And there, absolutely. I mean, I certainly could have used them more productively. I mean, I'm not better off. I don't know if any of my clients ever decided to send me money because they noticed I went to college. You know, I mean, I have to ask them, but, you know, I don't think it ever comes up, you know, in discussions.
How about Puerto Rico? Of course, you relocated there for reasons that a lot of people did. There's tremendous tax advantages. But of course, with the hurricane, it's just been complete devastation. What are your plans now?
Well, I mean, it's not complete devastation from my perspective. I mean, it certainly is. And I don't want to belittle the suffering of a lot of people because this was a horrible, horrible hurricane. And of course, the big problem with Puerto Rico is there's so much government here. So many things that should be done by the private sector are being done by the government. And so you can imagine how bad things are, how slow the response time is, how inefficient everything is. So this is the last place that you'd want to have a big natural disaster. But as far as my life here in Puerto Rico, look, you know, the power goes out. I got generators in, out. I mean, some things take longer to do here. People are busier, so it's harder if you need to get some service, but by and large, my life is still very good here. You know, so I'm, you know, more living in a bit of a bubble inside of Puerto Rico. So, you know, for me, the weather is still great and the tax advantages are still great. Yeah. You have some things that you give up, and a lot of people give up some of these things when you can even live remotely in the mountains somewhere in the US and you're going to, you know, some of the services that you get, your utility, your internet, I mean, might not be as good as if you're in a big city, but you get some other advantages. And so I'm living on the beach, and there's a lot of advantages to living on the beach. But there's, you know, it's not all pluses. There are some minuses of being in Puerto Rico, but the minuses are a lot smaller than people think. Because I really enjoy being here. It's not like, you know, I'm in prison the time I spend. I look forward to coming back to Puerto Rico when I'm out here. I mean, I really enjoy my time on the island. I mean, it's much better than being back in Connecticut, you know, shoveling snow. You know, I'd rather just have my bare feet in the sand and the surf, you know. And I go out at night, I don't even have to put on a shirt. You know, it's perfect temperature, you know. So, yeah, I mean, so if anybody's thinking about it, don't let the hurricane dissuade you. Yeah, I mean, my house got some damage and I've got it's still there. It's not like it's one of those straw houses that the bad wolf can blow down. I mean, it's a concrete house. I mean, nothing, you know, it's still there. I mean, obviously there's a little damage because the water it was a category 5. I mean, if it was a category 2, I probably wouldn't have had a problem. I mean, how often do you get hit by a category 5 hurricane, a direct hit? I mean, it probably won't happen again in my lifetime. I mean, knock wood or whatever I got.
Right. But, yeah, sure.
But, and of course, you know, obviously, there's some problems some opportunities have been created. There's probably a lot of cheap real estate that people can buy, you know, and rebuild. And, you know, there people have left the island, so I guess it's a little less crowded, you know. Hopefully it'll be an incentive. You know, they're talking about now privatizing the utility company, which is, you know, long overdue. You know, Puerto Rico has a massive amount of debt. Hopefully the hurricane will be a catalyst for the debt to be defaulted on. I mean, there is no way the Puerto Rican people should repay the debt that their government racked up. These hedge funds that own all this debt should just take their losses. They were stupid to buy the bonds in the first place. Even if they got them for 50 cents on the dollar, Puerto Rico can't pay 50 cents on the dollar. They don't have it.
All right. Now, as with a lot of our conversations, I like to have my episodes be a conversation, but here I really just have a series of questions because I want as many of my folks to get questions answered. So this has nothing to do with Puerto Rico. I just want to know about what you make of the string of major closures in the retail sector, whether it's Macy's or I guess they're trying to say every year some Sam's Club locations shut down. But this year it just seemed weird. You just showed up and the stores closed with no warning almost. And then we all know about Sears and Toys R Us. But at the same time, we're being told everything's booming. So what does this mean?
Well, I mean, everybody likes to dismiss it and just say it's all the Amazon effect, right? Amazon is putting everybody out of business. And, you know, certainly there's some truth to the fact that Amazon is making it difficult for a lot of the retailers because they can't compete on price. But, you know, Amazon has been doing this for a long time, and you haven't seen the retailers dropping like flies until recently. So, you know, what has changed? And what I think is going on is that the average American is just broke, and nobody wants to admit that, but we have record high credit card debt, record high auto debt, record high student loans. If you're still spending all your money paying off the debt from the stuff you bought in the past, you don't have a lot of money to pay for new stuff today. Plus, you know, wages have not been growing, but prices have been rising. So real wages have been falling. A lot of people that used to have full-time jobs now have part-time jobs. And, you know, so the household income is going down. I think that's the real story. And I think that within that, people are so pinched that they're trying to be as penny wise as they can. They're trying to shop as cheaply as they can. And that's where Amazon comes in, because I think that a lot of people, if they weren't so cost conscious now, wouldn't mind spending a little extra to just buy the stuff at the mall, you know, because you get it, you can pick it up, you can take it home that day, you get it immediately, you know, rather than ordering it and then waiting for it to show up in a box and then, you know, trying it on, maybe it fits, maybe it doesn't, then you have to send it back and get a different size. I mean, to me, I think it's more convenient to just buy stuff in a store. But if all you care about is cost because you're so strapped, because you have so little money, then you're going to gravitate to whoever can give you the cheapest price. And that's Amazon, because Amazon ships it for free. In many cases, there's no sales tax, and they don't even care if they lose money on the transaction. You know, we're an Amazon Prime member here in Puerto Rico. I buy my toilet paper from Amazon. They ship it to Puerto Rico for nothing. So why should I go to a store in Puerto Rico when they'll just deliver it to my house for free? Toilet paper. I mean, dog food too. I order big bags of dog food. It comes for free, no shipping. I mean, the shipping has got to be more expensive than the dog food that they're shipping.
Yeah.
So Amazon doesn't care. They don't care about making a profit. They just want to make the sale. So it makes it harder for businesses that actually need a profit to compete.
All right. Let me ask you about, of course, what's going on today and the current state of things. I had, let's see, who'd I have on? Kevin Duffy. Do you know him from Baring Asset Management? Do you know that name?
No, it doesn't ring a bell.
All right. Well, anyway.
Added names.
We were doing a thing on where is the bubble? And he's, of course, seeing it in a lot of different things. What do you think about the state of housing right now, given that housing played a major role in making Peter Schiff a household name?
Yeah, well, you know, housing is still a bubble. I mean, it's not the exact same type of bubble that it was, you know, before the 08 crisis, because back then it was rampant retail speculation, individuals loading up on multiple homes, no doc loans, you know, liar loans, I mean, all that. So that was kind of a crazy bubble. But real estate prices are still inflated because anything that is a function of interest rates, right, is going to be inflated based on artificially low rates. And so since most people who buy real estate finance the purchase, obviously the prices are higher than they would otherwise be if interest rates were allowed to be at a historically normal level. So as interest rates rise, real estate prices are going to go down. I also think a lot of private equity guys and hedge funds loaded up on a lot of real estate, and they own a lot of real estate based on the assumption that they'll one day be able to sell the real estate to the tenants who are now renting from them. I don't think that that's going to be the case. And I think eventually as interest rates rise and these properties no longer cash flow, and they may not even cash flow now, but I do think at some point real estate speculators are going to look to sell their single family homes to individual homeowners. And I think the prices are going to plunge at that point. But also, you know, one of the downsides, and it's not necessarily a negative of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, and maybe it's one of the few positives there, but they did take away a lot of the tax incentives that are there for home ownership. I mean, in order to take advantage of the tax breaks, number one, you have to itemize your deductions. And based on the increase in the standard deduction, a very small percentage of people are now going to itemize. And so for those people, you know, renting now is a lot better than buying because there's no tax deduction to make the cost of buying seem lower. So that's going to take away a lot of housing demand. And even on the higher end, though, the fact that you can no longer deduct your property taxes makes real estate, less desirable to buy. The fact that a larger interest on a larger home, you know, home mortgage is no longer deductible. And I know people will say, well, you still have $10,000 that you can deduct. Well, most people that have $10,000 worth of property taxes also have $10,000 worth of income taxes that they pay to the state government. So they will use up their entire deduction on their income tax. And so there'll be nothing left over for their real estate, which takes away the incentive to buy the real estate in the first place. So I think it's kind of a perfect storm coming for real estate. Rising mortgage rates that will make homeownership more expensive, the loss of tax breaks that subsidize homeownership, and the fact that Americans are broke. So real estate prices are still coming down. Obviously, they'll come down more in certain parts of the country than they will in others. But we're going down in the market, no question.
Well, where, if anywhere, do you see any signs of health?
In the U.S. economy?
Yeah. Is there any sector where you'd say, well, this is better than that one?
I don't think. Look, I mean, everybody wants to talk about the recovery in manufacturing, but I just don't see it. Our trade deficits are at record levels. If you take out energy, I mean, there is some health in the oil and gas sector. I mean, that industry has done well. And, you know, it's suffered with the big drop in oil prices, but oil prices are coming back. But, you know, overall, the economy is in bad shape. I mean, Trump has talked a lot about deregulation, but mostly all he's done is stop the new regulations that hadn't even hit from going into effect. We've done very little to repeal the regulations that have been undermining businesses these last 10, 20 years. I mean, they're all still there. We haven't gotten rid of Obamacare. They want to pretend that we did, but we haven't. So the government is getting bigger. Government is spending more money, which means it's draining more resources from the economy. So, you know, unfortunately, you know, the bright spots that I see are outside the United States. I mean, that's why I continue to invest money in countries that are moving from, you know, more government to less government. We're still moving from less government to more government. And we've got horrible demographics and we've got these unfunded liabilities that are, you know, hanging over us like, you know, the sword of Damocles. I mean, you look at other countries where people don't depend on the government, where they, you know, I mean, I mentioned, look at communist China. The people are self-reliant over there. The government doesn't have Social Security. The government doesn't have Medicare. In China, the people depend on themselves. In America, the people depend on the government. And, you know, that is a dangerous combination. But, you know, I'm investing in countries that will benefit from the growing economies abroad that result from more freedom and less government. But unfortunately, in America, we're going the other way. And politically, I am very scared because I think that Donald Trump and the Republicans have set themselves up for an even bigger fall than Bush. I think this next collapse, which will probably happen during his first term, not his second term, and it will deny him or any Republican a second term. But I think we're going to have a worse crisis than 08. I think the dollar is going to crash. I think the Fed is going to have to reverse course and do QE4 to try to prop up the markets in the face of rising interest rates, which is going to crush the economy and the asset markets. And I think we're going to go back into a worse recession than 08. And it's all going to be blamed on the tax cuts. It's all going to be blamed on deregulation. And the socialists are going to run to the rescue. It's going to be Bernie Sanders like the cavalry or his, you know, handpicked protege. And we're going to have a, you know, a socialist Congress. I mean, unfortunately, we have a two-party system now that consists of Democrats and socialists. Trump has made all the Republicans Democrats, and Sanders has made all the Democrats socialists. That's where we are.
Yeah, and it's hard to know how you ever get out of that, because even if you managed by some miracle to get a decent person in there, you're always up against that they're going to blame anything that goes wrong on even deregulation that doesn't exist, which is usually what they blame it on.
Just talking about deregulation.
Yeah, that probably spooked us into the problem. Let me ask you about what would be a, let's say you're somebody with a moderate risk appetite, what would be a portfolio allocation that you would recommend? And then secondly, suppose you lived in a country and in a world where central banks either, let's just say we're run by people who don't favor, let's say that you had central banks based on the original plan for the Fed. I'll even go with that. How different would your allocation be then? Would you be doing different things with your money if you didn't have to feel like you were constantly hedging against what governments and central banks were going to do?
Obviously, if we had a vibrant free market economy such that the founding fathers initially provided for us, if we had limited government and sound money, oh yeah, my investment advice would be completely different. But, you know, I mean, there's no point in talking about that because that's not the world we live in. So we gotta give advice based on where we live, not where ideally we wish we live. But the other problem is, your question is, if I wanted to be very safe and low risk, and you can't do that anymore. I mean, thanks to the government, there is no low risk investment. Everything you do is going to be risky. So the question is, which risk do you want to avoid and which risks do you want to take? So the risks that I want to avoid are the risks of the dollar crashing, the risk of the U.S. stock and bond market crashing. And so how do I mitigate those risks? Well, I am assuming other risks. So I'm getting into other currencies, but then, of course, I assume the risk that those currencies go down. I just think that risk is less likely than the risk of the dollar going down. I own gold to protect myself. But, of course, now I assume the risk that gold goes down. But I think gold has less of a chance of losing value than the dollar. You know, and there are stocks that I buy. I buy stocks for my clients all around the world, and I take the risk that those stocks go down. But I think there's a greater risk of just holding cash that loses its value. You know, I want to hold real assets that you know, can keep me ahead of inflation. Inflation is a big risk, and I want to mitigate that risk. And, you know, and so I try to buy stocks that are, you know, represent the best investment value I can find. I try not to overpay. I try to get a good deal. I try to get good dividends. I try to buy stocks in jurisdictions that I think are less risky than others, you know, where governments are making fewer mistakes, where their central banks are being less irresponsible. I mean, there's no perfect place in the world to invest. I mean, nobody looks exactly like 19th century America. But, you know, there are a lot of countries that are closer to what we used to be than what we are now. And so I try to, you know, invest like that. And I would encourage, you know, people, I mean, if you're still in the U.S. market, if you're still in the dollar, you know, don't wait. Don't waste any more time, because we're in the ninth inning of this game. And I think people have to get their portfolios, you know, properly allocated out of harm's way. And it's not only about avoiding losses. I think there will be real gains to be had from this major transition of wealth and purchasing power away from dollars to other currencies and away from Americans to other people.
Peter, I've got a bunch more questions for you, but let's pause for a minute to thank our sponsor. Folks, Peter and I have been talking just now about the troubles in retail, but there's one company that is absolutely booming for sure, and that is Harry's Razors. You guys know I'm a huge fan of Harry's. It's the official razor of the Tom Woods Show. I love the closeness of the shave. I love the attractiveness of the set as a gift. And as you know, I've given Harry's Razors as a gift. And in particular, I got the Super Deluxe model for our friend Michael Malice. Well, millions of men have switched over to Harry's. Jeff and Andy were just two ordinary guys, and they thought they were getting charged too much for razors. So they started Harry's to fix shaving. They stripped out the unnecessary features and the unnecessary costs to deliver customers one perfect razor at an amazing price. Well, Harry's is so confident you're going to love their blades, they'll give you their trial shave set for free when you sign up at harrys.com/woods. Just pay for shipping. That's a $13 value, and it includes a weighted ergonomic razor handle, 5 precision-engineered blades with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, a rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover. To get that free trial set, go to harrys.com/woods right now. That's harrys.com/woods. I've got a lot of people listening to this who are very interested in really getting a handle on what they ought to be doing with their money. And they have all, I have people of all walks of life with all different amounts of money. And they're people who have been very successful in this field or that field, but that doesn't mean they know therefore, now that I have all this money, what I should do with it. We all specialize in something, and you specialize in managing money. So obviously, they can work with you or one of your brokers at Euro Pacific Capital. What do you, you know, let's say I'm a guy who's got, I don't even want to specify a particular amount of money because I have people, as I say, of all different levels. What are you going to do for them? What are they call you up and what happens?
Well, I mean, what we do is we set up an account and we assess their situation and give a recommendation on, you know, how to, you know, have me manage their money. I mean, I can manage a portfolio. I have 5 mutual funds that people can be invested in. I have a wrap program that includes all my funds. I have separately managed accounts. First, you know, just need to make sure that people understand what they're doing. They understand the risk and the rewards involved in the strategy. And then just implement it. I mean, I think it's financial life or death here. I think the vast majority of Americans are going to get wiped out as the dollar collapses. I mean, this is not going to be pretty. We're going to be paying the piper for years and years of living beyond our means. But I think if you do the right thing with your assets, then, you know, you won't suffer like everybody else. I mean, you'll have real financial security. Now, of course, I can't stop the government from later coming out and confiscating everything that you have. I mean, if we go full on, you know, socialist, communist, or something like that, I mean, who knows? I wouldn't put it past these guys. But at least I can make sure that the returns are there, that financially that you have assets that the government might want to seize.
Some time ago, I guess it was years ago now, I think when the Occupy Wall Street movement was just getting started, you went down into one of their demonstrations and you had a sign that said something like, "I am the 1%, let's talk," something like that. And you actually did. Yeah, okay, good. And then somebody had a camera and this wound up on YouTube. What exactly did you tell those people?
Well, I mean, it wasn't like somebody happened to have a camera. I mean, I went down there with Reason Magazine, and the purpose of my going down there was to put it up on YouTube. So that was all planned, but there was nothing scripted about what happened. I went down to Zuccotti Park to the Occupy Wall Street protest, and I engaged the people there for a couple of hours in unscripted one-on-one dialogue, which was filmed, and, you know, got a lot of views. In fact, some website last year just resurrected it, put it up on their website, and got another 3.5 million views, you know, several years later. So the information is out there. And the reason I went there was not to try to convince a few hundred people at Zuccotti Park that capitalism was good and socialism was bad. I mean, that was because I knew my audience there was limited. It was the audience that I knew would be watching over the years on the internet. And I have gotten a lot of emails, many, many emails, too many to even, you know, count, from people all over the world who have told me that before they watched this discussion, they were in fact socialists and now they're free market capitalists. That was enough. And maybe it wasn't all, but then that pointed them in the right direction. They did some more reading. They educated themselves. And that was the turning point in their lives where, you know, it was the aha moment where they realized, you know, the truth, right?
That's incredible.
Yeah. And that was the goal. I mean, I thought, let me just, because people say, why were you so patient? Because I had to be patient. I wanted people to hear this discussion back and forth. To understand the points I was making and the absurdity of the points that these occupiers were making. And so it was very educational. Whether or not it had any impact at that park on those people, I have no clue. But I know that it had a lot of impact beyond that. Now, of course, most people that watched it probably didn't have their minds changed. I mean, I know that from arguing with socialists. It is very hard to change anybody's mind, no matter how reasonable you are. But there is a small percentage of people who are still open-minded. You know, they're not completely brainwashed. And if they just think, if they use their brain, there is no logical way to defend socialism. It is impossible. As long as you are thinking clearly, and that's hard for so many liberals to take the emotion out of it and to be willing to concede that they're wrong about something. But if you actually think about it logically, free market capitalism, libertarianism, that's the only thing that makes sense. Everything else is, you know, you just is all full of holes.
I know I said I'd let you go. I got one last thing, and then we'll give the website for your Pacific Capital. But When it comes to gold in particular, what is there a particular reason that you'd want to have physical possession of some gold, some mining stocks, index funds? How would you decide between these different ways of having gold, in effect?
You want to own, physical gold is an insurance policy. It's just in case you need it. Maybe you'll never need your physical gold. It's kind of like a gun, right? I mean, you buy a gun hoping that you never need it, right? I have guns. I have a gun right by my bed. You know, I hope I never have to use it, but I have it anyway, right? You know, just like, you know, you hope you don't use your, I hope my life insurance policy doesn't get used. So you have physical gold, you know, in case you need it, but you hope you don't. But, you know, but beyond that, I mean, I own gold stocks as an investment. I own gold stocks because I believe gold's going to go way up, and I think gold stocks will go up even more. So I buy gold stocks to profit from the move that I expect to happen in gold. I buy physical gold in case all hell breaks loose and I need it. You know, so otherwise I wouldn't have that much. I mean, yeah, I mean, gold is pretty, but I'd rather have it around my wrist, you know, in my watch. You know, actually, there's a gold money launched a new company called Menet, M-E-N-E, which is an old ancient word for money. But they're making gold jewelry now out of 24 karat gold. And they price it based on the price of gold. So if you spend $1,000, let's say, on a necklace, you're buying $800 worth of gold. So you could turn around and sell it back to them for $800. So in a way, you know, you're paying a little fee to have a designer to have some jewelry, but you can actually wear some of your gold. But worst case, you got it. You know, it's not like you're buying this 14 karat, 18 karat gold where you buy a $1,000 necklace and you got $100 worth of gold. I mean, that's not a gold investment. But if I can pay $1,000 for $800 worth of gold, okay, I paid $200 for the necklace and I still got $800 worth of gold. But so you can have some physical gold. But I think you should have more money in investments that will profit from the rise of gold. Physical gold, you know, 5% of your net worth, 10% max, you know, if you really want to be, you know, you really want to play it safe. But beyond that, I mean, if you think gold is really going to go up, you can invest in things. That's why we have, I manage a gold fund, the Euro Pacific Gold Fund. I think there's an incredible opportunity. If I think the price of gold is going up to $5,000, $10,000, imagine what that does to the profitability of a gold mining company. So I want to own that gold mining company to profit from the rise that I expect to happen in gold. But that's very different than buying gold. I'm not buying gold because I want to make money on the price of gold going up. I'm buying gold because I want to preserve my wealth when everything else comes crashing down. So I'm not buying gold to get rich. I'm buying gold not to be poor, but I'm buying stocks, gold stocks, to get rich or richer, however you want, what your perspective is.
All right, smart, smart. All right, so how do people contact you guys? And is there a minimum amount of money they would need to invest to even be able to talk to you?
Well, I mean, there's no minimum. It depends on what they want to do. Just to buy some gold, you know, from Gold Money, you can buy $50 worth of gold at goldmoney.com. Right. You can call up Ship Gold and you can buy $5,000-$10,000 worth of coins and we'll ship them to you. You can buy my mutual funds, Schwab and Fidelity. I manage those funds. The minimum investment in my funds is $2,500. So you can go there and buy my value fund, my gold fund, my dividend payers fund, my emerging market fund. They're there. But, you know, generally to deal with me direct at Euro Pacific Capital, there's a minimum maybe $25,000-$50,000. And you talk to a broker and, you know, we'll figure out what the right products are for a separately managed account of individual stocks. The minimums are $250. So it depends on what you want to do, or $250,000. So it depends on the type of account, the type of service that you need. But there's always a way that I can help you. If you've got wealth that you want to protect, even if you have a small amount, there's a way for me to help you protect it. But if you have a large amount of wealth, then yeah, it's even more important that I protect it, because if you have a lot of wealth, you've got a lot to lose.
All right. So the website, of course, is europac.com.
Yep.
And I'll link to that at tomwoods.com/1100. This is episode number 1100. And you're still doing the Schiff. You still have schiffradio.com, right?
Yeah. And I don't do that daily radio show that you were so gracious to co-host. And you did such a great job when you did that. But now I just do a podcast and I usually do two or three a week. And they're usually around anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour, depending on, you know, how long I can talk or how much I've got to say. But yeah, you can listen to them on Schiff Radio. You can listen to them any, you know, get the podcast anywhere. I put them all up on my YouTube channel, you know, Peter Schiff channel, whatever. So yeah, make sure you're listening to those podcasts, watch those video blogs. I mean, go to my website, sign up for my newsletter or my database. I mean, always try to, you know, follow me and get the information, because, you know, As you know, the conventional media, it's all fake, right? We're the real news. We're telling the truth. Everything else is regurgitated government propaganda, Wall Street propaganda, Keynesian nonsense, you know. So, you know, we're out there trying to educate the public, educate investors, so that when it all hits the fan, you know, some people will know who to blame, right? It's not capitalism. It's not the market. It's government. It's crony capitalism. It's the central bankers, right? They're the ones that are responsible for the problem.
Well, I'm going to have a whole bunch of links to precisely those things at tomwoods.com/1100, as Peter Schiff's smorgasbord will be waiting for you there. Thanks so much, Peter. We appreciate the time.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, everybody. Here's what I'm going to play for you. This is from CPAC 2010. That's the big conservative political action conference. The Ron Paul people totally took that thing over for a few years running. It was unbelievable. We were everywhere. And, you know, the little snotballs who wanted to listen to Mitt Romney speeches were not really... they were not where the energy was coming from, I'll put it that way. And I know I shouldn't say things like snotballs, but once in a while, I mean, look, you hang around with these people that you don't even think exist. Is there really a 19-year-old person who wants to listen to a Mitt Romney speech? And then when you meet them, you're just so horrified that such people exist. It's hard to, you know, so I know I shouldn't say things like that, and I'm usually on better behavior. Anyway, that's a separate matter. That I think it's understandable. Once in a while, you just can't help it. Anyway, the point is, we had this great event at CPAC, where we had a couple of speeches, and then I was the moderator of a question and answer session where on the stage were Ron Paul and Judge Andrew Napolitano of Fox News, and we solicited questions from the audience. It was a packed hall. I don't remember how many people there, but it was a ridiculous number of people. But as the moderator, I had the privilege of asking the first question, and I forgot about this till somebody reminded me the other day. I asked Ron Paul the most clever question I could to trick him into telling us whether he planned to run for president in 2012 or not, because if, especially you youngsters may not remember just how interested we were in this question in 2010. We didn't have a clear answer. And if you came right out and asked him, because somebody in the audience actually yelled out, 2012, and I said, ah, come on now, you know he's not going to answer that. So I more or less cornered him into answering. And I have to say, this is one of my prouder moments, so I hope you enjoy it. Here we go. We're going to take questions here. You can come up to the microphone. We have two microphones, so we'll start here and then go back there and alternate. But as the MC, I'm told that I have the privilege of asking the first question. And boy, have I meditated on this one. Okay? No, no, no. See, he'll give us some slippery answer to that. Okay? See, that one's too easy. No. So no, I originally did want to ask that, but I thought, no, he's not going to answer that. And I understand that. I'm not, you know, I don't want to be too flippant here. So I came up with a sort of different question that I think will sort of trick him into answering that one. And it's basically this. My question is to Congressman Paul. Now, looking back on the presidential campaign, we know what the results were in terms of bringing out, as you said, all these people and so many young people. We've got the Federal Reserve now being discussed as a political issue. We've got a position where people realize that concern for civil liberties is not something that mamby-pamby left-wing America haters care about, but are a serious issue. They're part of our civilization. We understand now that maybe there's something a teensy-weensy bit not conservative about our foreign policy. This is actually getting out into the mainstream. And Austrian economics is undergoing the greatest rebirth it has had since F.A. Hayek won the Nobel Prize. So here's my question to you, Congressman Paul. Given all that, now I understand, I can't begin to imagine how physically and mentally taxing it is to run for president, but I guess my question is, given all this, these wonderful results, and that maybe our numbers could triple if you were to run again, what good reasons can you give us for not doing it?
Next question. Well, it's too early to make rash decisions.
Oh. You're not evading the question, Congressman.
I would never evade a question. I don't know the answer.
Oh, well, that's actually a good answer. He can't think of any reason not to do it, folks. All right, everybody, that is going to do it for today. I hope you enjoyed that little bit there. Just to, you know, I've been a little bit nostalgic lately about the Ron Paul days, and I hope that brightened your day a little bit. All right, that's it. If you're not listening to the Tom Woods Show regularly, tisk tisk. You're getting a lot of information on this show every day if you tune in. So make sure and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. You can find the subscription links as well as all 1,100 episodes linked on a single page at tomwoods.com/episodes. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.